Convening this meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. It's February 22nd. We are starting with a work session, Department of Human Services Integrated Eligibility Project. Ms. Bond?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, the Department of Human Services is here this morning to give you a short presentation on a project it's requesting funding for this biennium. This is the Integrated Eligibility Project. In ELLIS, you'll see a presentation. You will see a recommendation from the LFO analyst. You will also see a recommendation that came out of the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Technology for you to review. The department received some planning money to start working on this project in the 15 session. It was expected they would have come back with some kind of ask or permission for next steps as part of the 2016 legislative session, and they've done that.
Okay.
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, Clyde Psyche, Interim Director for the Department of Human Services. And with me at the table is our Chief Operating Officer for Technology, Sarah Miller. And we're here today to share information with you on our integrated eligibility project. So I'll make a few comments and then turn it over to the expert. So the project really will increase efficiency and will take us to a place where if a person comes in for services, they'll only have to provide the basic application information once. Unfortunately, the way we're set up now, you may have to provide the same information for every program you're applying for services for, which I know is a very frustrating thing for people who are coming in for service, and it also creates an additional administrative burden for our staff. The system will also, as a person applies for benefits in any program, the system will also let the caseworker know whether or not the person is eligible for other services, which I think will be very beneficial to our clients. We also have an opportunity to leverage federal funding for the majority of the project if we move forward quickly. And then finally, we are building the integrated eligibility system on existing technology or the technology we've implemented for our partners at the Oregon Health Authority, what's commonly known as the One system, which Sarah will go into detail. And I guess one last thing I would say is that we really have a sense of urgency in moving forward because a lot of the systems or applications that support our current programs now are either near end of life or past end of life. And if those systems go down, we may not be able to bring them back up. And so it really behooves us to move forward on this project. And with that, I'll turn it over to Sarah.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Miller. Today I'm in front of you in my permanent job as DHS's COO for technology. I've been in front of this committee several times in an alternative job because for the last 15 months I've been on job rotation at the Oregon Health Authority doing the One System implementation. You'll see from this presentation that it makes sense for me to go back to my permanent employer and carry on the work that I've been doing on behalf of Oregonians should you all decide to move forward with this project. So you're the budget committee, so let's be really clear about what we're asking for the remainder of the biennia. So we're asking for federal fund limitation in the amount of $40.2 million. We're asking for $7.5 million in Q bonds to fund the state match for this project, $90,000 in cost of issuance limitation, and then 35 limited duration positions. This is in addition to the permanent positions which you've previously given the agency, which we are reallocating for this project. So let's just give you a brief overview about what integrated eligibility is. I apologize to Representative Nathanson and Senator Steiner Hayward, who heard me give this same slide about a week and a half ago in front of the IT subcommittee. But as Director Psyche said, the benefit of an integrated eligibility system is a family can come to the front door of either agency, can complete a single application, and then the computer system is smart enough to apply rules to the information that's provided. And OHA can continue to use that information to evaluate a family for Medicaid that's on the basis of your income. We call that MAGI, Modified Adjusted Gross Income. After integrated eligibility is implemented, the Department of Human Services would be able to take that same information and evaluate a family for eligibility for other kinds of Medicaid that are not based on income. We call those non-MAGI. You might know them as categorically eligible for aged population, blind population, disabled population. Also for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, that's our food stamp program. For temporary assistance for needy families, that's cash assistance. And for employment-related child care. So if you give us permission to move forward, both agencies will be able to evaluate eligibility for five singular programs. That really matters because you all probably know better the work that we've done in Oregon to transform the healthcare system and really coordinate care both from a physical and social determinants of health perspective for family. And so to have a single eligibility system that removes barriers to access for care for Oregonians is a very compelling mission, we believe. So let's talk a little bit about what we've done today. You heard your staff person, Ms. Byerly, talk about that you authorized us in the 15 long session to begin a planning effort. We stood up a planning project in April of 2015. In August, our federal partners at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, those are the federal funders for Medicaid, told us that we had to use a single eligibility system for all Medicaid programs. And if we wanted enhanced funding, our only choice was to move non-MAGI Medicaid into the one system. Once CMS gave us that direction, then we started investigating the use of a federal policy waiver we call A87 Cost Allocation Exception. So there's federal rules that require normally a benefiting program to pay their fair share of the benefit that they receive. But when the Affordable Care Act came out, everybody knew that CMS had more money than any of the other federal agencies to support IT systems. And so they put in a policy waiver to that cost allocation requirement. And that policy waiver actually remains in effect until December 31st of 2018, which is why Director Psyche says we have great urgency about this. So we knew that we were going to have to use the one system for MAGI Medicaid, but before we took on the other human service eligibility programs, it was really important to me to take a set of people who actually do the work in the field to Kentucky and look at the system in pilot. So remember, KINECT got implemented in Kentucky, and we spent the last 15 months bringing it to OHA and making it one. While we were doing that work, Kentucky was taking KINECT and adding human service programs into it. They call that system now Benefind. And so what we're talking about doing is bringing the Benefind solution here to put on top of the one solution. I can tell you after that site visit, there was a good match found to exist between our programs. Our programs are very similar in criteria and caseloads. Our policies actually line up across this suite of human service programs in a way that are generally good indications of a transfer system project might be a good fit for our business need. And so it was the opinion of the site team, it was the opinion of the project team, and then became the opinion of DHS's executive team that we should move forward with a request for an integrated eligibility project, not just a non-MAGI project. You know, because I was in front of you, OHA implemented that system in production on December 15th, actually about 10 days before that, but the official go-live was in December for workers to use to do MAGI Medicaid. In January of this year, the department received its Stage Gate 2 endorsement for the Integrated Eligibility Project, and so we're here in front of you requesting legislative approval to proceed.
Ms. Miller, would you please, just in one sentence, describe for this committee, a budget committee, what it means to have Stage Gate 2 approval?
Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. So the Office of the State CIO, the governor's chief executive who has responsibility for IT oversight of IT projects, has a process where they check the work that an agency is doing on IT projects at various stages of the project. So Stage Gate 1 is earliest idea. You can generally expect agencies to seek that endorsement when they're putting together POP requests for new projects. Stage Gate 2 is you know, ready to begin detailed planning. So it's more than an idea, but we haven't done the detailed planning work. Between Stage Gate 2 and Stage Gate 3 is all the formal project management planning that should result in a schedule estimate and a budget estimate that are within 10% of what you can expect to be done. So for us, in the context of the DHS project, Stage Gate 2 says, we've picked a system, we think it's a good business fit, we have a vendor who's going to deliver that system for us, but now we need to do the detailed planning work in order to be able to produce a schedule and budget estimate that would be plus or minus 10%.
Thank you.
Director Psyche told you a little bit about why we have this urgency, and the scales are meant to be a visual image for you. So if we do integrated eligibility in an integrated way, that means all four department programs together, what we're able to do is leverage more 90-10 money from CMS, our Medicaid partner, than if we were to do it in a phased way. So CMS always pays 90-10 money for eligibility systems. So when we're doing non-MAGI Medicaid, we're always going to get 90-10 money. But if we were to do non-MAGI Medicaid first, that would take us about 24 months, and then we'd come back and want to do a SNAP and TANF. Those agencies fund really differently. So Food and Nutrition Services is the federal agency for SNAP. They only ever pay 50%. So if I was to come back with another $80 million project to do SNAP, then the feds would only pay 40% of that. TANF, because we're a block grant state, their federal agency, Administration on Children and Families, actually pays 0%. If we were to use any federal dollars, it would be direct dollars away from service delivery. So when you put these three programs together and you get to ride the coattails of the CMS 90-10 money, it actually turns into a blended rate of about 85% federal money and 15% state funds. Additionally, you get to have sort of one set of overhead for the implementation of a project instead of doing a bunch of the same work multiple times in phases. So if you look down the criteria, right, our best estimate for the work that we did in the business case says we can do integrated all programs at the same time for less than $130 million. If we do non-MAGI first and then others, you're going to be in the ballpark of $160 to $200 million. Takes longer to do, which I think is counterintuitive. When I was in front of the IT committee, they were like, how can it take longer to do more, except that you have this leverage of expertise. So the practical matter is, in some of our DHS field offices, the people who do SNAP and TANF are working together with people who do aging and people with disability determination. If we do that requirements work together, if we do that design work together, we leverage that expertise in a single cycle. So it's the difference between a 33-month project and somewhere between 48 and 80 months, depending on how we would phase the implementation. There's also significant operational impact, right? I know that you guys care a lot. I was a clear advocate in the 2015 session for limited scope and bringing forth the non-MAGI planning project. And some of you might say, Sarah, why have you changed your mind? And I'll tell you, it's because I went to the field and I watched our caseworkers do the work that they do. And right now, DHS caseworkers use four different systems to determine this eligibility. If we were to make the one system be a required system for non-MAGI Medicaid, then they would use five. So the operational impact for our service delivery to Oregonians is really different. On top of it being legacy systems that we're worried about the fragility of, the demand that we would put on caseworkers, and the amount of time we would require caseworkers to interact with systems instead of people, right? You all want them doing the work that only people can do, which is to be people helping people get the services that they need, not interacting with screens, doing data entry into four or five systems. So from a technology impact, you know, please don't misunderstand Director Psyche or I. We have a number of IT employees who spend an inordinate amount of time trying to keep these systems alive. There is nothing that they could do that would make it better. And we owe an extreme debt of gratitude, in my opinion, for the fact that those systems have stayed functioning in the way they do. But we continue to need to be able to sunset or partially sunset those systems in the future. From an implementation perspective, Director Psyche talked about, right, the implementation risk is really lower. If I was in front of you and we didn't have the one system installed here in Oregon, integrated, actually working, my risk reward chart would look really different, right? But the reality is, in either approach, the technology risk is the same. Because what we're going to do is take the technology that's been implemented, we're going to add additional business rules, make modifications to the screens that do data collection, and we're going to implement it. There are only two new pieces of software, so I need more servers, more security appliances, more network, but it's not new technology, and it's all in play and working with the exception of two products. And so the technology risk is really consistent for both, much higher for business process. So this slide sort of shows you the process that we would use to go through this project. The first phase is probably the thing that's most important, the thing that gets us from stage gate 2 endorsement to stage gate 3 endorsement, is a process we call FitGap. FitGap will take the functionality of the Kentucky system and will evaluate it against Oregon's needs. In places where that functionality matches up, we call that a fit. So that means no technology changes needed, no business changes needed. In places where that functionality doesn't match up, we call that a gap. But gaps can be solved in lots of ways. We could change policy, we could change procedure, we could defer a requirement, we could, you know, sort of fourth on the list, go ahead and change the technology. And the magic of system transfer, right, is you don't take a system and then bring it here and then break it by changing it in a bunch of ways. The magic of a system transfer is you pick a system that you think is pretty close to meeting your business needs, and then you do everything you can to change your business operations in order to use the technology in the way that it works. And so FitGap is the opportunity for us to identify both the technology changes that would be needed, but more importantly, probably the business and operational changes that would be needed.
Yes. Thank you very much. I just want to make a quick comment. Obviously, Co-Chair Nathanson knows this because she's on that subcommittee, but we've been dealing with the Department of Revenue's core system transformation project for the past 5 years in general government sub, and it is exactly because of what Ms. Miller is describing. They are adapting their policies and business practices to the existing commercial off-the-shelf, in this case, commercial off-the-shelf software that 20-plus other states and jurisdictions have already implemented, rather than adapting the software to their business practices, many of which are outdated. And I commend DHS for taking this approach because I firmly believe it's an enormous opportunity to look again at business practices and figure out which ones make sense and which ones don't, and how do we streamline things. So I just wanted to bring that to the committee's attention because I think it's the right approach to be taking. Thank you.
Thank you.
I will chime in after you. Both Senator Steiner Hayward and I have sponsored bills that this legislature has passed and the governor has signed, which point us to this kind of solution. So
yes.
You have two people here very interested in the outcome of this.
Yes. Thank you, Co-Chair Nathanson. And also for the benefit of the rest of your committee members, it's also DHS's opinion that this technology solution is the greatest tool to advancing House Bill 2219, which was the policy bill that got passed in the last legislative session requiring the department to look towards a single streamlined application for human services. And so this technology investment really enables the advancement of that policy agenda. Once we finish the FitGap phase, which we expect to do in the summer of 2016, then we do both work on the technical side with our system integrator, Deloitte Consulting, and on the business operations side. And so we design the changes that need to be made, then we build the changes that need to be made, and then test is the phase where we bring together the technology changes and the business process changes and make sure, right, that the business is going to be ready to use the system when the system is ready for the business. And then our federal partners will require, in terms of implementation, a two-month pilot where we can only roll it out to a limited geographical area. And then it's the opinion of the department that phased implementation, sort of geographical area by geographical area, makes the most sense. And so we'll spend about 4 months rolling it out. And so you all could expect, if you authorize this project, that in December of 2018, we will have converted the system and begin to decommission legacy systems. So the other topic that we just wanted to lay on the table for you, because there's been lots of conversation about it, is sort of how does governance of one work, right? If you have two agencies and two agency heads who would benefit from the system, how do you resolve that problem? And I don't want you to think that we haven't spent lots of time talking about it. So Kristen Deuce, the CIO for both agencies, is here, and she and I are working with Director Psyche and Director Saxton to develop a joint enterprise system governance process. And what you could expect a joint governance process to do is prioritize enhancement work for both agencies, make decisions about the strategic roadmap of the future system lifecycle. Senator Steiner Hayward took me to task in committee in January about, have we spent enough time thinking about what the lifecycle is so that in 20 years from now, your replacements won't all be having a conversation about this legacy system being on its last leg. And so, you know, I think that's a good responsibility for joint governance to do. And then management of state commitments to the vendor. So in both cases, Deloitte Consulting is acting as the single system integrator. So OHA has finished essentially their base implementation and has Deloitte on a maintenance and operations contract. DHS is preparing pending legislative approval and the governor signing to sign a contract with Deloitte to do the system integration work. Well, so if you're the system integrator, you care a lot about that there's a single person who has responsibility for both sides. And so Director Saxton and OHA, in a spirit of partnership with DHS, have agreed to let me act as the single state executive. So I have contract administrator responsibilities for their maintenance and operations contract, even though I'm not an employee of the Oregon Health Authority. And the department, who I'm permanently employed with, has made it clear that it will be my baby to get to deliver the DHS Integrated Eligibility Project. And so from a vendor management perspective, from an opportunity where there could be inefficiencies, you guys should know that we've worked very hard with the vendors to make sure that they get a clear sense of direction from a single person whose job it is to make sure that both sets of needs are met. And so we haven't worked out all the details, but there's a strong commitment on behalf of both agency directors because I think both of them see the benefit to Oregonians for doing an integrated system. So that's the remainder of our prepared testimony. Happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Senator Bates.
Just a couple of quick ones. I probably know just enough to be dangerous here as usual, running with IT. We have been doing a lot of electronic medical records, and our last one was $25 million and very complex. And there were a couple of things we learned from that I wanted to ask questions about.
Sure.
Here, okay. First one, since we are on old systems that are also failing, what do you think the risk of failure of the old systems are going to be in the next 33 months? Are we at real risk of some of those going down? And then we'd lose the data and all the eligibility stuff. What do you think that risk really is?
Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee, it's my professional opinion that there is moderate risk that there would be failure. What we know, right, is every day that goes by from the original day it was built, there is greater risk that there would be some failure. But we have done lots of work to mitigate that risk and continue to make investments. So these are mainframe systems. Mainframe systems by nature are generally more stable. That technology doesn't evolve as quickly as traditional server technology does. So certainly there's risk and there's real risk. But, you know, CIO Deuce and her staff, management staff, continue to try and hire in a staff augmentation way or provide approaches that make sure we'll have the expertise if there's a problem. We work with Dr. Pettit and the management team at ETS to make sure that the hardware is stable. So there's real risk. But in my opinion, it's not going to be less risk for waiting to start this effort.
Follow-up questions?
Yes.
Do you back up the system daily? The old system, and will you be back up a new system daily and taking it off-site?
Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee, so the mainframe does, in fact, have backup jobs. I can't speak to the frequency in which they operate, so I'll have to take back the question about is it daily or weekly. But the one system has three levels of backup right now. So we back it up inside of the one system in case there's any hardware failure. We've built it to be fully redundant so that any portion of the hardware can fail and the system can continue to operate. And then we're working with ETS in 2016 to implement a full design disaster recovery environment, which would say if there was catastrophic failure here, we could continue to operate it at ETS's offsite data center in Helena, Montana. So that's not fully implemented yet. It would be by the time integrated eligibility was completed.
I'll take the rest of that question offline. That still concerns me. Mm-hmm. I think you should be physically backed up in place somewhere different than the site you're at. I have concerns.
Okay.
Second question, if I may. Or do you want to let others ask questions first?
There are no other questions. I'm just...
What about the time?
Fine.
I noticed in the write-up you don't know the maintenance costs. Frankly, when we buy our systems in the real world, we know the maintenance costs before we finish the system. You have no choice. We've got to go forward. But I'd like to have a report back to us as quickly as possible what you think those maintenance costs would be. And maintenance of the system can be out of state, India, Pakistan, I don't know, Bangladesh. But what we usually do is require the company that we're working with, which was Epic, to allow us to maintain the system locally with local people trained to do the job. I'm hoping that when you have these maintenance contracts with your integrator, that you will require those people to be in state, working in state, either on contract or, you know, through the office of IT. I just don't feel good about shipping this kind of money outside the state and then losing control of a really good backup. When we worked with Minnesota and Epic, we had all kinds of problems. Once we brought them into state and we had our own people, things started settling down. So I hope you would consider that as part of this as you move forward to what I call Stargate 3.
Co-Chair Bates, certainly I hear your message and we will consider it in our detailed planning. You can expect when we come back for Stage Gate 3 endorsement, we will have some expectations around what maintenance and operations costs will be.
And the last question is really not a question. Come back to us and tell us how you're going to prevent the system from being hacked.
Co-Chair Bates, I will come back whenever the committee summons me.
I'm really concerned about that. We're seeing it all over the country right now.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
And I'll be quick. I appreciate Co-Chair Bates' question about maintenance, but would add that it would be very interesting to know how much it's costing us to maintain the system now, because every system requires maintenance, and it'd be interesting to see what those costs are going to look like compared to what we're paying now for that. The second question is this. Are there thoughts about ways that we can connect this new system with child welfare? Because we know that a lot of child welfare situations are around neglect, and a lot of those relate to poverty. And I'd be curious to know at some point, if you don't have the information now, down the road, I recognize that there are confidentiality issues, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But frankly, a lot of times child welfare cases can be addressed by addressing some of the poverty issues that this new system will, I hope, address.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Bates, Senator Steiner Hayward, to your first point, yes, we will take it under advisement and come back and have conversations with you all. To your second point, relative to integration with child welfare system, the FITGAP phase will be the place where we establish what interfaces will exist at initial implementation should we get approval to move forward, and what interfaces should exist subsequently. And so you can expect a detailed inventory. I mean, the benefit, right, of having it be an integrated eligibility system is I regularly get DHS executive team time at our executive meetings to talk about this effort, and I'm doing that with my child welfare peers at the table. Certainly the existing child welfare system, ORCIDS, has an integration to MMIS because it does eligibility for Medicaid for kids who are in the foster care system. So it would be natural for us to consider that partnership in the future. I can't speak to whether it would be in existence in the initial 33 months or subsequently, but we'll definitely do that analysis work and report
back.
Thank
you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Ms. Byerly, would you please give us the LFO report?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, in your Manila today, there was a recommendation from the Legislative Fiscal Office. On the last page of that are some detailed recommendations. I'm not going to go into all the numbers, but generally, Legislative Fiscal Office recommends that the funding for this project be included in the budget reconciliation bill, assuming that the appropriate level of bonding authority is also authorized. Again, there's a lot of work being done in the overall state budget around those components. That the limited duration positions being requested are approved, and that we would, just so you know, ask that the Department of Administrative Services unschedule the project funding until we have a little bit better of a release plan as far as giving the limitation to the agency for spend. The Office of the State CIO, LFO, and especially the LFIT, LFO information technology staff are working with the agency on refining that plan. As Ms. Miller mentioned, we don't have precise reporting requirements in here, but I'm sure we can invite the agency back at any legislative days to present and provide you information as well. There's nothing that prohibits the agency providing information in written form to you over the course of the project to keep you updated. So I'm sure you'll be seeing all kinds of information on how the project's going. And then lastly, I recommend that you adopt the recommendations that were provided through the Joint Legislative Information or Committee on Information Management Technology that were dated February 12, 2016, and those are included in your packet. And that includes a series of very specific actions the agency is supposed to take in concurrence with our office and the Office of the State CIO.
Thank you, Ms. Byerly. And yes, indeed, the JLCIMT recommendations are also very detailed. You all will be very busy reporting.
I will do the same that I did the last time I got a list of Mr. Cummings' recommendations and say, I Brownie Scout promise we will do them. I did the last ones. I will do these ones.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, are you ready for a motion?
I am. Thank you.
I'm not going to repeat LFO's recommendation. I'll just say I move approval of the LFO and JLCIMT recommendation.
Thank you. Is there discussion on the motion? Objection? Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
No, this will be, if approved, this will be incorporated in the big bill that goes to the full committee, so we don't need a carrier for this
All right.
project.
Thank you.
Thank goodness.
because of the way the information is organized for us in on our agenda this morning, I'm going to continue to the next work session on Senate Bill 1585. It's my intent, because we have a member of the legislature waiting to testify, to change the order of the following work sessions so that 4030 will be immediately after 1585. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 4071 relating to health care for Pacific Islanders.
We were ready for that.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're going to leave that one open.
Well, close the work session. I'm not sure. Okay,
leave it open. And I'm going to also open a work session on House Bill 1585 relating to state finance.
Madam Co-Chair, thank you for making that adjustment so your analyst doesn't panic, because I don't know anything about the other bill.
Well, that just makes it quicker.
Representative Olson will fill you in.
So, in all this today, and excuse me, I'm a little bit rusty because we haven't had to handle any bills yet, so here we go. So the in all this today is a copy of a memo from our office, a copy of a fiscal impact on the Dash 1 amendment to House or Senate Bill 1585, and preliminary staff measure summary on the bill. So this bill came to you from the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. It has two components, and then with the amendment, would have a third component. The first part of the bill makes a change to related to Senate Bill 72 from the 2015 session. That bill established a $9 surcharge on nursing license fees to go into a special fund that gets distributed to an organization that helps advance nursing in Oregon. The change in this bill also applies that $9 surcharge to licenses that are approved by the state board through an endorsement process. It just clarifies that those licenses also, or that fee also goes to fund for those licenses. The estimate related to this as far as revenues is about $32,000 a year that may end up in the fund because of the additional pieces. The second part of the bill deals with the Department of Human Services Nursing Facility bed buy program that was put into place as part of Senate Bill 220 or House Bill 2216 in the 2013 session. This set up a process for nursing facilities to buy beds from closing nursing facilities to try and consolidate those bed resources. That bed buyback program expired at the end of 2015. This legislation would extend that through June of 2016 and provide a little more flexibility and participation, because instead of actually completing the purchase, the facilities can actually just enter into the plan and be eligible for the program. The fiscal for that is indeterminate. It'll be based on participation. There already are some funds in the human services budget that should be able to deal with that in the current biennium. If participation is higher, we may need to look at modifying that in the next biennium. Then finally, the amendment before you today gives the Department of Human Services flexibility to establish a separate pediatric subacute reimbursement rate for certain pediatric nursing services. Currently, only one rate is allowed. Both the Oregon Healthcare Association and Partners have would like to have the flexibility for this second rate so that they can look for some alternative ways to treat some of the younger nursing clients in ways that may be a little bit less costly. There are some representatives here today if you have questions on the amendment or want a little bit more information.
Thank you.
Motion. Ready? Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1585.
Discussion on the motion regarding the amendment. Objection. Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1585, the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, with a do pass recommendation as amended.
Discussion. Since we're on the main motion, I will mention that the most exciting question I got related to this bill is, why is the word endorsement spelled with an I?
My question, too.
And there's a reason. It's a legal thing about a signature on a document, yes. But it was not a typo. Huh. The spelling was correct.
No additional
discussion. Objections to the motion. Motion passes.
I need carriers for this bill, for full and for the chambers.
I'll just take it in full. It doesn't matter. You're in full.
I'm in full. I don't care.
You want to do it?
It doesn't matter. Okay. Sure. Whatever the chairs want.
Who's in full on the House? I always forget.
None. Just Nancy.
Nobody except Nancy.
Nancy is.
It's just the three of us. We're the only ones on the Senate.
Whatever.
I really don't care.
I'll be happy to take it.
You take it.
This is fine.
Okay.
That's fine.
In the House or in the House?
Well, let's consider the first chance.
All right. The Senate, because it's the Senate bill.
Gotcha. I just thought we were always the first.
So who's going to? You're going to do it in both? Unless Senator Devlin wants to do it in the Senate. It's Senator Devlin's bill. You can do it.
Oh, I'll take it then, okay. Unless he wants it.
All right.
Sure. I just want everybody out here that's listening to us that we're normally not like this.
Like the Three Stooges trying to go through a door. I really don't care if that's what.
I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 1585, and I am opening a work session on House Bill 4030 relating to medical assistance reimbursement of emergency medical services. Ms. Ames.
It's a sprint this morning.
We could be out of this.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, House Bill 4030 requires the Oregon Health Authority to develop and implement two programs to better reimburse emergency medical services and transportation. One program that would cover fee-for-service and one program that would cover CCOs. Providers who chose to participate would contribute funds that then could be leveraged to result in additional federal match for the programs. The bill also requires the agency to convene a work group to develop recommendations to align this program with the goals of healthcare transformation more generally, including metrics. The new programs are not actually operative until July of 2017, so if the work group did recommend some things that needed statutory change, that could happen in the 2017 session. The fiscal of the bill is indeterminate. The agency identified some specific costs relating to IT system changes of about $300,000, but there are other unknown costs that won't be known until the actual details of the program are worked out and the number of participants is determined. The bill does state that general fund cannot pay for these costs, and it is assumed that the revenues for the administration of the program will come out of fees from the providers that chose to participate. And LFO recommends that you move this to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Representative Doherty.
Okay, thank you. Co-chairs Nathanson and Bates, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Doherty. I'm the state representative from House District 35, which is Tigard and Southwest Portland. And I'm here to urge your support of House Bill 4030A. A little background of the bill is when a Medicaid patient receives emergency medical care and transport, the Medicaid reimbursement rate is to the provider is far less than what the actual cost for providing the service. The gap between the compensated and uncompensated cost is now being shouldered by the EMS, emergency medical system providers. And in the case of city, county, and district providers, it is paid for by the taxpayers. House Bill 3040A will help EMS providers achieve reimbursement for their uncompensated costs through a federal program entitled Ground Emergency Medical Transport, or GEMT. In addition to providing revenue, critical revenue, House Bill 4030A would also assist with healthcare transformation efforts in Oregon. GEMT would involve no increase of the overall cost at the state or local level. Several states already have this program, including Washington and California, and we would like Oregon to join them. So I ask that you join me in getting this bill passed so work can begin to allow the GEMT to benefit Oregon's EMS system and the patients that rely upon it. Thank you.
Thank you. And I understand we're aware that this bill was amended in committee. Chief Groves, welcome to the committee, and can you give us a little brief introduction to what the bill's about and what the amendment does?
Thank you, Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee. My name is Randy Groves, and I am the fire chief for the Eugene Springfield Fire Department. Speaking specifically to the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments, the Dash 1 amendment is what forms this committee that you've heard some about through the Oregon Health Division, where stakeholders, key stakeholders, public, private, nonprofit, will be coming together to try and work through and develop the rules that will go on to CMS for the reimbursements. The Dash 2 amendment actually takes this a step further and allows the private entities to come in. We still don't know how that will be ruled through CMS, but we're going to do what we can to make this legislation equitable to all. And if you want to hear a little bit about why this is important to Oregonians, you've heard a lot about what the bill is, but if you could indulge me just a few minutes here to talk about why this is so important to us. The face of EMS is changing in our state. We have a number of challenges, and I think the best way to put it in context is to describe it around my agency, my communities that we serve. The Eugene Springfield Fire Department operates the largest public ambulance system in the state of Oregon, and we protect a population in excess of 240,000 people, including our 8 contract districts. We also serve a rural population in excess of 270,000 combined. It's important to understand that not only do we use our own resources to respond on this, we also respond in rural Lane County with volunteer agencies. We operate a busy system with our 2015 call volume exceeding 36,000 responses, and we transported over 20,000 patients. That's an increase of 1,000 patients over 2014, or 5%, and many of them are Medicaid patients. Having been in the fire and emergency medical services industry for almost 37 years, I've watched our capabilities and sophistication advance, but I've also watched a growing number of our people become more reliant upon the 911 system in our area hospital emergency departments for minor and routine care, services that should be provided through primary health care. This new reality is adversely impacting our entire system, tying up emergency response capacity and jamming up hospital emergency departments. It is also driving up cost. My community's burgeoning homeless population, increased number of patients with mental health problems, and increased number of people without the capability to manage their conditions or the understanding of how to access primary health care is stressing our system, the system not designed or intended to operate in this manner. Simply stated, our 911 system and hospital emergency departments have become the default point of entry into the health care system for a growing number of our community members. And despite significant changes we've already made to our system needs more innovation. Our system needs to be more responsive to changing conditions. At the same time, innovation cost money. House Bill 4030 would allow us to collect additional Medicaid reimbursements under a formula that includes the first tier of our response, not currently covered in the calculations under Medicaid. This first tier of our service is primarily provided by government EMS providers, most of which are fire service agencies. In my community, additional funding will help us develop more appropriate and humane ways of addressing the needs of our changing demographic while preserving our emergency response system for all community members. HB 4030 will also support our volunteer firefighter EMT first response in rural Lane County. In closing, I want to emphasize that the current Medicaid reimbursements, which account for almost 24% of our transports, are capitated and do not cover the full cost of delivering the service. In 2015, our department treated and transported close to 4,800 Medicaid patients, resulting in millions of dollars that are being absorbed by our system. While it will not completely close the financial gap, this enabling legislation would help us access additional funding, new dollars, that are already available through the Medicaid entitlement program. It would return some of our constituents' federal tax dollars to our communities so that they can be invested locally in our pre-hospital care system, where they will do much good. I want to emphasize that HB 4030 does not draw from existing funds that are coming into our state, and it does not reduce Medicaid reimbursements currently enjoyed by nonprofit, private for-profit, or government ambulance systems. Please support this important legislation, help us reduce the Medicaid cost recovery gap, and help us protect the communities we serve. I'm now available for questions, and I have some of my colleagues here with me that would be happy to help answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd like to thank Representative Doherty for introducing this bill, and Chief for your statement, which covers most of my speech here today. I have firsthand experience, and this has served 16 years as a volunteer firefighter in my district, and my husband is currently still the chief, and we know very well what you're talking about. Many of the people in our rural, and it's all volunteer, by the way, nobody gets a dime. We respond to a call, comes in, you know, a medical emergency, they don't know what it is, but it's people looking to see, basically, should I really go in and get this addressed? And they're using firefighters, volunteer firefighters. The highest level of training could be a paramedic, but most of those already work for an ambulance service or in a hospital situation, not in a rural area. We just don't have them on our team. We have first responders and some what used to be called basics. And so they're not really qualified to make these medical decisions and to default back to addressing potential liabilities. In the end, we send them in, and a private company comes and picks them up. So we use our resources, our time, our people. They come from work, wherever they are, when they get the call. And he's absolutely right. This is a growing problem. In some cases, these are homeless people or people who are camping in the area, you know, where I live. And it's always been an issue, but it's getting more and more the norm. And so if you're responding to that call, you never know how many people are going to respond to the call. You might have two or three, or you might have six or seven. But then you get an MVA with six patients. What do you do? So thank you so much for putting it more succinctly than I could. And I support this 100%. This is very much needed.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Bates.
Just a quick, not question, a statement, I guess. One, I'm going to support this bill for two reasons. One is the work group. The basic bill is great. The work group is going to be really important. We want to make sure this works for nonprofits as well as public. And the other issue I hope that will be discussed in this situation is quite often we have overlapping coverage. And I've had times in my office when we've called 911 and we have two different groups show up to try to help out with a patient being transported to usually hospitals, what happens. And that's an issue that I would like to see discussed and make sure we build the right capacity. They're all on the same frequency for radios and all that stuff, because some of it's not happening. And we will have a further discussion on it. If the group works in that, we should be okay. And second reason I'm going to support this is because about 3 weeks ago, maybe a little longer than that, I came home after a long day at the office, seeing 40, 50 patients, totally exhausted, and I get a text from my next-door neighbor to stop at his house and have a discussion about this bill. And he's the fire chief for District 3. Yeah, sitting in the back. And he's sitting there having a nice glass of wine. I'm totally exhausted. And we go into the bill for about 45 minutes. So first, I appreciate him putting me through the bill. And secondly, next time I stop at his house, I want it to be for social reasons, okay? Thank you for coming up here, Dan. Appreciate it.
Yes, you can see.
Other questions for this panel? Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Ames.
All right.
Need a motion.
You ready for a motion?
Yes, I'm ready.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4038 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Discussion? Objections? Motion passes. Well, that was quick, wasn't it? We need carriers.
Right.
So, did one of you want to do it at full?
We're scared to say anything because you got on us last time.
I would be grateful if I could, Madam Chair. I'm one of the chief sponsors.
That's
of the bill,
terrific.
So I'd be grateful, and I can take it in the Senate as well.
That's okay with you. Representative Doherty in the House.
Good.
Good.
Okay.
Is that all the business on this bill?
Right.
I'm closing this work session.
We should go to.
And
I don't think we're going to do 4071. I don't think we have questions.
News bill.
Well, let's do 4124 and then stand at ease for a second, and I can go and find out where we're at.
Thank you. And I'm opening a work session on House Bill 4124 relating to prescription drugs.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, House Bill 4124 requires the Oregon Health Authority to modify the prescription drug monitoring program to allow authorized practitioners and pharmacists to access the program information through a health information technology system. In addition, the bill permits pharmacists and other specific health professionals to prescribe and dispense one dose naloxone.
Naloxone.
Did I get it?
Naloxone.
You're close. Call it Narcan.
Mm-hmm. The fiscal impact of the bill is estimated at around 100,000 other funds in one position. The program does have adequate revenues to do this work without a fee increase. The agency has sufficient other funds expenditure limitations, so we did not add that limitation into this bill, but the position will be included in the budget reconciliation bill.
Yes.
Thank you. I have the privilege of co-chief sponsoring this bill with Representative Bueller. This is a really important bill for several reasons. As most of you know, we have an opioid epidemic in Oregon, and this bill is designed to address two concerns about that. The first is that Oregon, probably five or eight years ago now, passed a bill that developed the Oregon Prescription Drug Monitoring Program that allows healthcare providers across the state to access a centralized database of opioid prescriptions that have been filled across the state. This allows us to look for people who are getting prescriptions filled from multiple providers or off-cycle or anything like that to address issues around overuse or diversion into the black market. There is also in Oregon a remarkable system called the Emergency Department Information Exchange, or ED, that I think this committee has heard about in the past, that every single hospital in Oregon participates in, where one can look up, emergency physicians can look up in that system whether a patient's been seen in another emergency department across the state in the past, I can't remember exactly how long, but reasonable period of time. Again, this allows people to avoid duplication of tests, understands diagnoses that have been made in the past, consider other options. However, logging into two separate positions to programs, both of which have their clunky moments with their user interface, especially the PDMP, is complicated. Integrating the PDMP into ED so that doctors only have to log into one program to get both of these sets of information, which are critical toward addressing Oregon's opioid abuse epidemic, will make a big difference and help, because emergency departments are one of the places that drug seekers tend to show up. The second piece of this bill that addresses it is the naloxone component. Naloxone, otherwise known by its trade name Narcan, is an opioid antagonist, which means that it blocks the effect of opioids. When given in a timely fashion to people who are suffering from an opioid overdose, it can reverse the effects temporarily, allowing time to seek appropriate emergency treatment. It does not prevent a need for an emergency department visit. It often prevents the need for very expensive hospitalization in the ICU. So it really has significant potential to change the dynamic. It's a safe drug to be used by non-healthcare providers, and many family members know when they have a family member who's addicted to opioids, and this can be an incredible life-saving drug to have available. So I am honored to work on this with Representative Bueller. If I may, I'd like to add one other point that's not specifically related to this drug. Some years ago, you'll remember in 2013, we passed a bill to allow entities such as schools, restaurants, camps, to have one or more of their staff members trained to administer epinephrine using what's commonly called an EpiPen in the case of a potentially fatal allergic reaction in somebody who's not carrying a pen or may not even have known that they were allergic to a particular substance or insect bite. It took a while for the health authority to get on board with making rules. They started last summer. There was a fair amount of confusion about exactly how this was going to work. Suffice it to say that as long as we get on record that the intention of this legislature had always been that the entity could receive the prescription rather than an individual, and that the entity itself could store in appropriate ways the prescription rather than having an individual do it, and that it's clear that the free drug, because the manufacturer, Mylan, intends to distribute this drug for free to entities such as schools and other similar organizations, that they will be distributed through something that is registered as a distributor of drugs with the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. We don't have to change anything in statute. So I'm getting that on record. If anybody has any questions about that, I'm happy to answer it. But I think that the health authority is nodding their head, and the Board of Pharmacy, they're not in the room, but I've had this conversation with them, will be happy once we get it on the record that that was our legislative intent. Happy to answer any questions about any of those three parts.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Ben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I did when you were saying that, Senator. If someone administers Narcan who's not a doctor, medical professional, how long do they have before they need to get to the doctor?
I'll cross-check with my colleague, but usually they've got a couple of hours before the drug wears off. But it's not just getting to a doctor, it's calling 911. Right. This has to be handled by emergency professionals, and it has to be done through an emergency department. I would not want one of these people showing up in my office, nor would Senator Bates. These have to be done by hospital-based emergency departments so that if, in fact, the patient needs high-level services such as intubation and ventilatory support, because that's the major effect of opioids, which is respiratory depression or making people stop breathing, that needs to happen in the right setting. So that's why it doesn't preclude that need. They just gives them time to actually get EMS there for appropriate treatment.
And to further answer your question, some of it depends on how much is on board with the patient.
Right.
Okay, if you have a huge overdose, give them the Narcan, and they may be good for 10, 15 minutes. You may have to repeat it after that until you can get them to a facility where you can intubate and maintain them. Because what it does, it blocks it, doesn't take it out of the system. And so if it's a mild overdose, it's one thing. If it's a heavy overdose, you got to keep hitting with it until you get them to the hospital and get them in. So in your area, for instance, it could be a long way to the hospital, but the EMTs would be able to keep the patient going with repeat hits of Narcan. They'd probably get an IV going and give it IV instead of IM. But that's the way it works. It's a very safe drug. It just stops happening. Mm-hmm. Probably the biggest risk to it is it's possible with a sudden cessation of the effect of the narcotic, you might have a seizure, but you probably wouldn't. So,
and it's safer than dying from respiratory suppression.
Yeah, I mean, you got no choice. You got to save the patient.
Yeah.
Thank you for pointing that out, because I was thinking if something like that happened and then, we got them back and then leave. Yeah.
No. There would be appropriate training given by the pharmacist, as there is with any drug, and there would be a lot of publicity about how to use it safely. I think the number of people, frankly, who will take advantage of this will be small, but we know that people have family members. I've had conversations with people in this building who have family members that they know are addicted to opioids, and as much as they're trying to help them, they haven't been able to help them get sober. And having this around would give them enormous peace of mind. A lot of these overdoses happen at home.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Much less intelligent than my colleagues here on this statement, but I have to give props to the supporters of this bill in the manner in which they've gotten this before me, because last week I made a statement that I had never heard of naloxone, and over the weekend I had two pop-up banner ads on my computer about it. So I don't know how you guys did that, but well done.
Yeah, that was not our doing, I can assure you.
Just a quick, I know we got to get going here, just a quick statement. We have some anecdotal evidence that some of these people who go through the process of getting Narcan It kind of starts them on, down the path of getting off narcotics. A lot of them have quit because of going through the near-death experience and then recovering. So there's some indication that it has another benefit from that point of view. The other thing, since the OHA is here, and I hope the pharmacy board is listening, we have two problems in the PDMP yet. One, it's getting harder and harder to read it. Information's coming to us in a way that's very difficult. In our office, we use it almost daily, if you can believe that.
Oh, at least.
And so we're into it all the time, looking things up and documenting that we looked at this for the given patients. But it's almost impossible to read now because the dates are getting flipped, and it's very hard to follow. That needs to be cleaned up. Secondly, we're finding in the last 6 months that pharmacists aren't putting information in the system fast enough. I mean, we've had several cases where a prescription was written by another physician for a narcotic, and we know the patient got it. It's not in a PDMP, and it comes in very late. So we're going to ask the pharmacists to step it up and get it in, as well as start a cleanup on the system so it's quickly and easily read, because right now it's getting more and more difficult to use. I know that's not in this bill, but I wanted to get that out. Thank you.
It's good to have that information known and in the realm of public discussion. I'd like to have a motion at this time.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4124A to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Is there additional discussion for the motion? Objections? Motion passes. A carrier for full. That would be Senator Steiner Hayward.
I'm going to switch that. I want to
in the Senate and in the House, it's Representative Bueller, I believe. Yes. Good. I am closing the work session on House Bill 4124. We had already opened a work session on 4071, but we're going to stand at ease for a moment. Thank you. Okay, we're out of recess now. We were in a work session on House Bill 4071. Excuse me. We were in a work session on House Bill 4071. That bill is not quite ready for its work session to be completed. We need to wait for a technical issue to be resolved. We expect this is going to be posted for a work session on Wednesday. So I'm closing today's work session on House Bill 4071. We expect to be back at this Wednesday, and we're adjourned for today.